Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Write Club. The first rule of Write Club is you don't talk about Write Club, but we'll make an exception in your case.
Hello, and welcome to Write Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. Today, we have a full house. I'm joined by Teresa, Heather, Linda, Nicola, and Steph.
Hi.
Hello. Hi.
This week on Write Club, we're going to be talking about hot reads for the hopefully hot weather. We'll be thinking about the sorts of books people read on holiday. And later, we'll be interviewing Simone Hubbard, the author of Under a Greek Spell. Before that, Linda is going to be reading from her work in progress. Nicola is going to be talking about what's hot in the movies. And Steph and John Lomas Bullivant will be telling us what's on their bedside tables. But first off, Teresa's going to ask us to
name the novel.
Indeed I am. Pen's ready. I think this is not too difficult, this one. I have a feeling Kevin might get it on the first clue, but we'll see. Clue one. Published in 1963, this espionage novel was the author's third book, but the first to achieve international acclaim.
Got an idea.
Might be right. Might be the right idea. Clue two. It was filmed in 1965 with Richard Burton in the lead role. The novel... The novel was listed in Time magazine's all-time top 100. Clue three. Set in the Cold War, the plot concerns a British agent who longs to end his career. His controllers, however, are determined to bring down the head of East German intelligence and topple his organisation. So he's sent once more into the fray, this time to play the part of the dishonoured spy and lure the enemy to his ultimate defeat.
Is it John le Carré?
It is John le Carré.
I think
Pat might know it.
Yeah, because at first I thought, oh, is it Tinker Tailor? But
yes, I wrote down.
When you said Richard Burton, I've never read it and I don't even remember seeing it because I was very young. is it The Spy Who Came In From the Cold?
It is indeed. The Spy Who Came In From the Cold by John le Carré.
I should have got that from the cold weather, the Cold War. Yeah.
I've got John le Carré.
I thought
Tinker Tailor.
Well, he's written many books.
First clue, I thought The Day of the Jackal.
Right.
The first thing I wrote down.
Okay.
No, I got it from the Richard Burton film.
There you go. It was quite a revolutionary novel in its time because le Carré had insider knowledge of British intelligence. That certainly gave an authenticity to his writing. But what was revolutionary was that he really exposed the amorality of the intelligence services on both sides of the Iron Curtain. So it was not heroic in that sense. According to Time magazine, it's a sad, sympathetic portrait of a man who has lived by lies and subterfuge for so long he's forgotten how to tell the truth. So it exists in that moral ambiguity, amoral sort of territory. I love John le Carré. I mean, I haven't by any means read all his books, but I do think he's a brilliant writer and I do enjoy reading his books.
Thank you, Teresa. Linda, you have another helping of Mary Magdalene's Journey.
I do have another helping.
Can't wait.
It's been a while since I've read. So Mary Magdalene, the last time, was... They were at the drugstore, their trailer had a flat tire, and we know it's been vandalized.
I missed that.
Okay. And Melba was very interested in having handsome Eli around. And Mary Magdalene is not really crazy about the way Melba looks at Eli. So this is where we are now. The trailer's been sabotaged, and Melba has invited them to stay. Mary Magdalene didn't want to go to Melba's house. "Well, we thank you for offering, but we're better going back to the trailer," she said, looking at Eli as she spoke. "I don't know about that, Maggie," he said. "It's been tore up pretty bad. It'd be dangerous, I think, sitting all lopsided, no electricity, dishes are broke all over, even the light's been torn out of the walls. If it's such an awful mess, we'd better get started cleaning it up," she tried again. Eli took off his hat and scratched his head. I don't think so, Maggie. Melba nodded, chewing her gum faster. Her forehead wrinkled as she listened. No, you don't want to stay there, sugar. Like your daddy said, Angel, it's dangerous. I got an extra bedroom where your daddy can stay, and I'll make the couch up for you real comfy. We sure do appreciate that, Miss Melba, said Eli. Then turning to Mary Magdalene, he said, right now I'm wore out, Maggie. Let's just go on for tonight and we'll figure out what to do tomorrow. Early the next morning, she and Eli walked to the empty lot across from the feed store. The little trailer looked sad and broken. Her heart fell. She ran to the open door. What she saw made her so mad she wanted to raise hell and stick a chunk under it. Everything was everywhere. Broken dishes, drawers open, clothes on the floor, and flour poured over all of it. She stepped in to get a better look down the hallway into the bedroom. You come out of there now. Eli stood in the doorway and reached for her. You'll get hurt in this mess. He grabbed her arm. Wait! She was practically screaming. She had spied the wreckage of her most treasured possession, the framed photograph of Eli and her mama, where Eli stood behind mama, smiling, with his arms wrapped around her chest, and mama leaned back against him, laughing. The frame was twisted, the glass shattered, and the picture torn. As she pulled away from Eli, she fell onto the glass shards and cut her leg. Damn it! She yelled. Damn it! Damn it! Damn it! Eli's jaw dropped. Maggie, what are you saying? You ain't old enough to be cussing like that. He stepped in and lifted her. Look here, you're bleeding all over yourself. Girl, you've been too hard to raise for me to let you take this kind of chance. Look here what they've done to my picture. Damn it to hell. Stop that cussing this minute, he shook her. You want me to get tough? I can't stop. I'm too mad. She looked at him, tears streaming, her hands shaking with anger. Well, then say, darn it. It ain't vile enough, she sobbed, clutching the picture. He carried her outside. Let me see that. Eli blew across the old Kodak paper to clear any bits of glass and let his eyes rest on the torn black and white image. He drew Mary Magdalene close to him. They stood in silence and let the photograph draw them back to happier times. Eli's voice was soft. We'll fix it. He moved his thumb near Raylene's face. See here? There ain't a scratch on her. Look how pretty she is. When at last Mary Magdalene could speak, she snuffled. Do you ever miss her, Eli? His eyes were wet, and he pulled her into his chest. Every day, Maggie, every single day. She put her arms around him and sobbed. When she could speak, she said, it's all right, Eli, we'll fix it. We'll tape it together and get a new frame. We'll fix it.
Wow.
I just love the change of mood and pace.
It's so moving. It's really, really poignant and moving. A really powerful piece of writing, and I think you will have your readers in tears.
I nearly cried.
Absolutely beautiful.
Really?
Yeah, it's lovely.
That's so
and
nice.
I thought that I love the genius bit where he's saying, stop cussing, and she says, I can't. He says, well, then say, darn it. I just thought that was, that was lovely.
Yeah.
There's a couple of things I wanted to ask Pat's advice about. I've noted you've got, like your daddy said, Angel. And daddy should, I think, I would do that with daddy with a small d because it's your daddy. Oh. And Angel with a capital A because it's addressing her directly.
Yeah, I thought of
and similarly a. with the framed photograph of Eli and her mama would be a small m, but then later on with his arm wrapped around her chest and mama leaning back against him, the mama would have a big m. Mm. Is that right?
Yeah.
Wait a minute, I'm lost here, wait a minute.
So when you were saying your father, your mother, your...
It's a lowercase.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or your daddy.
Uh-huh.
Because lowercase. It's not a direct
name.
Name. Mm. But if you're saying, hey, mummy, or please, daddy, or what
if you're using that as the name.
Yeah,
right.
Instead of their name. Or,
Interesting.
But what I'm saying here, the framed photograph of Eli and her mama.
Is her mama would be a small M. Uh-huh. And later in that sentence where it says, where Eli stood behind her smiling with her arms, with his arms wrapped around her chest and mama leaning against him. Mama would be capital because as you've got
it. Mm. Okay.
Because
it's okay, I got it. Mm. So, I think I got it. Okay.
But I mean obviously people at home can't see those things. Mm-hmm. So that just shows you how I was
looking for something.
Looking for something.
Well, it's an important point of writing.
Of writing. Yeah.
People is it the first time I've heard mama's name?
Yes, I think it is.
No, actually, it was somewhere before, because we were talking about the sisters, Faynelle and Raylene.
Yes. Yeah.
But it's been a while. It's been a while ago. Yeah.
But I immediately knew that's who it was.
Okay. Yeah. I knew it was. I just wondered if it was the first time.
I wanted to just ask you about when they're having the thing about, you know, come on, Maggie, we need to stay. He calls her Maggie three times.
Mm-hmm.
And always before... Mm-hmm. When he calls her Maggie, she objects and says, it's not Maggie, it's Mary Magdalene.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, when he says, and I can see why she's not doing it now, because she's too busy trying to persuade him not to stay there. But when he says, right now I'm wore out, Maggie, let's just go on for tonight, and she knows she's beaten, I just wonder if she might then rebuke him and say, hey, I'm not Maggie, I'm Mary Magdalene.
Right, right.
And I thought... it might be a nice touch then if later on, when he's hugging her and his eyes were wet, instead of calling her Maggie, he actually calls her Mary Magdalene.
What a good suggestion.
That might be another way of showing that he's, he's tender towards her because he's actually
called. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
But just a suggestion. It's not a criticism at all.
I think that's a very good idea, though. Yeah.
I particularly like some phrases in this. There's always a trademark humour until it gets to the point where it's, you know, very poignant. Girl, you've been too hard to raise for me to let you date this kind of child.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
I mean, the dialogue is pitch perfect, true to character, true to situation. I absolutely love it. I love that Eli and Mary Magdalene have this tender moment as well. I think that's really important. And what I really especially love is... in the end, Mary Magdalene reasserts herself as the parent.
After
this moment of weakness.
Yes. Yeah.
And she will fix it. And she's reasserted her leadership there.
Yeah.
And I just think it's brilliant.
Fabulous.
I did have a query, which is not a writing issue, but about small town morality.
Uh-huh.
And is you know, Melba's inviting this single man to stay there. And whereas she might be brazen... but would Eli, as a preacher, feel he was doing something a bit naughty, a bit that would be talked about? Put it that way.
Yeah, he hasn't become a preacher yet. He was just singing on the square, but he's playing with it. Mm. I thought about that too, and I thought, you know, it's the 1950s, and it's a small town. It's a churchy place because all of Appalachia was that way, and so. I don't know quite what I'm going to do, but there needs to be some reference or some solution to that. I did,
or maybe a hint, or maybe even Mary Magdalene thinks that can't be proper, or Aunt Sugar wouldn't like it, or maybe a little bit to suggest that what they're doing is a bit of a risk. Really,
I mean, she might be cross with him as well that he stayed at Melba's last night, and now her mummy's picture's been. Destroyed, and maybe I don't know if that happened while they were at Melba's.
Well, we're assuming the vandalism happened before.
It did.
Okay. So it wouldn't be that she goes, "See what you've done by staying with that woman."
Melba has no reputation to lose.
Yeah,
you know, we don't know anything about her.
I love Melba. I want Melba and Eli together.
Yeah. I loved Melba nodded, chewing her gum faster.
I know.
Yeah.
I love that.
About to get her wish granted.
Yeah, I did.
You can see her salivating.
I was kind of half expecting, I know what you're saying about the sort of morality thing, but I was half expecting there to be just a little hint in between, you know, we'll figure out what to do tomorrow and then early next morning.
That's why I thought maybe this is the point at which she says, oh, will you stop calling me Maggie? My name is Mary Magdalene, and stomps off. That. I thought that would actually bring that part of the scene to a close.
But on the topic of transitions, one beautiful sentence that moved us, they stood in silence and let the photograph draw them back to happier times.
Yes.
You actually felt yourself sort of slip back a bit.
Yeah, it was lovely.
It changed the mood completely in one sentence, so well done.
Yeah.
Brilliant
yeah.
stuff.
Yeah.
I have to tell you, I did cry a few tears when I was
reading. Oh, good. I cried when I read it.
You yeah. did? Yeah. Oh, good. Absolutely. And Al was sitting on the couch. I said, I'm crying if I don't read it.
I've moved myself.
Where's my notes?
Thank you well so done. Very much. Well thank done. You. Well, thank you all for that wonderful critique.
And thank you. Okay, over to Nicola.
Right, well, reeling from the shock of the withdrawal of Game of Thrones being over, and I know that some people here haven't watched the final episode, so
I've never seen one episode.
I haven't glad to hear that. I haven't either, and I thought I was the only person on Earth.
No, I'm the other person on Earth that's never seen a single...
Me too.
Three people on Earth that have never seen
eight thrilling seasons, and you've missed out because the story... I was watching something that was analysing why it was so popular, and it says something along the lines of, this is not a story of dragons... It's a story. It's a great story with the occasional dragon.
Right.
And I thought that was interesting because it was, you know, they were talking about how easily it's sucked so many people into a fantasy story. Mm-hmm. And that's quite a rare...
But it's about yeah. politics, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know,
and then the other thing they said was that everybody found someone to identify with. So that was really good, even if they obviously ended up dead after a little while. But then I saw a marvellous thing, and the Westeros-shaped hole might be filled again by a prequel, which is going to be written. It might be called Blind Moon. And the thing that really caught my eye was five writers took a stab at developing the Game of Thrones prequel story. Among them was Max Borenstein, Jane Goldman, Brian Hedgeland, Carly Rae, and Brian Cogman, who have all got very good credits. But who the thing that really thrilled me was it's Jane Goldman who got the job. And Jane Goldman, you may know, she adapted Neil Gaiman's Stardust a few years ago, but she's the wife of Jonathan Ross.
Yes.
And she really got very good attention from writing Kingsman, The Secret Service, The Golden Circle, the sequel, X-Men First Class. And the thing that I particularly loved that she wrote was Kick-Ass, which was almost our first feminist Marvel hero kind of character.
Right.
She's British, of course.
Yeah.
Will there be any dragons? Unlikely, apparently. You're looking at a whole different era. It's going to be about 5,000 years before, and it'll answer some big questions like where did the Ice Walkers come from and things like that. So I'm looking forward to that already.
Wow.
Great. Mm.
She wrote...
I read something quite interesting about the last season of Game of Thrones, which people said wasn't quite up to the standard of the previous ones. And apparently the first... seven series were all based on the actual books by George R. Martin. But the last series was done by scriptwriters, and people felt it wasn't quite up to the standard. Mm. It was the quality of the writing.
Well, that's interesting. I did pick up when researching this that he has written more books. So the actual books continue, although the television series most definitely will not. It's going back in time. So I just thought it was more about the cinematography on the last series. It was all a bit too dark. On occasions. The Long Night, I think the battle was called, number three.
The article was very much about the importance of the writer.
Oh, okay. Right, yeah, right.
Which I thought was a positive message.
Yes.
Okay, well, thanks for that, Nicola. We said we were going to talk about summer reading, what's hot in the world of books rather than in the movies. Because it's that time of year, isn't it, when newspapers, supplements and magazines are full of suggestions for what you should take on holiday with you. Because people do that, don't they? When they go on holiday, they buy books. Even people that, you know, normally never read seem to think, oh, I'll take a book. But what do they read? And I think there's an assumption that we all want something nice and light, something frothy. You actually skim through Amazon's or WH Smith's suggestions, and just note how many times you read the words heartwarming, uplifting. And apparently these are the qualities that make for the perfect summer read. And the other thing I noticed was the covers, all these bright, can you have bright pastels?
They're bright
pastels with lots and lots of turquoise. But not everybody wants a light, undemanding read. I mean, a lot of people prefer something they can really get stuck into.
Well, we found this when we interviewed on the beach last year, didn't we, Stephanie? People were reading thrillers and historical stuff and dark stuff, crime.
Yeah.
Really gruesome murders. We set old ladies reading really dark things.
Things about forensic anthropology and all that. You know, and we did expect that they would be reading sort of lighter chick lit or romance, but we found very little of that.
Well, I think quite often in your normal day-to-day life, you don't always have the time or the mental energy to get stuck into something, to read heavier things or even sort of quite demanding stuff. What I always used to find was when I was working particularly, my sort of personal reading tended to be done just in bed at night. And every night I'd find myself having to go back at least two pages to work out. And it used to take forever. And it's just nice not to, to be able to not lose the thread of the book. But there was some research, psychotherapist says vacation heightens our capacity to immerse ourselves in a good read, and because quite simply we're more open to it. He said, in our regular lives, we're all overscheduled and probably stressed. And he talks about the heavy cognitive load we carry each day, the constant need to sort and weigh information in an overstimulated environment. But he says, when you're sitting on a beach, the cognitive load is very low, which I think we can all agree with. And you have time to wander, to let your mind wander, to be really curious. But he says, vacation not only primes us for the pleasure of reading, it can also make the experience more beneficial. In particular, reading literary, character-driven stories can make us more open, empathic people after we go back to work. That's according to Keith Oatley, who's a novelist and the author of a forthcoming paper on the psychology of fiction. That'll be an interesting read.
But it will add to my cognitive load, of course.
Yes, it will. But that's quite interesting. You go back to work and people say, oh, you're a lot nicer than when you went away.
Yeah.
You're being very empathetic. It's not like you. You're normally a cow.
I did think when you were talking about you don't have to be worried about looking around and stuff. If your mother's with small children, you can't reach. You have to keep your eye on the water and be sure that they are.
I know a lot of mothers with small children who use audiobooks.
They have wireless earphones,
which means they can't hear the children.
But their
screams reach.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
But they keep an eye on them.
That's one reason why families take grandparents on holiday to look after the children. so they can enjoy their absence of cognitive load.
Mm. Yeah. So what about you? What do you like to read on holiday?
I like literary books anyway and non-fiction. And, you know, for me, a light read would be something like a crime thriller. So I just read a wide variety. I don't know that I have anything specifically holiday-oriented that I read. Although, like Stephanie has said before, something set in the country you're going to is fun, but it wouldn't necessarily be a light read for me. When I was going to Portugal, I read Ballad of Dogs Beach, I think it's called, which was a book set, it was a crime, but it was set during the dictatorship under a sort of right-wing regime, so it was quite dark.
But and of course, everybody that ever went to Kefalonia took Captain Corelli's mandolin for about 10 years. Which is great, because it actually got people reading what I consider to be reasonably good writing.
Which is always good, literary fiction.
I remember going to, when we did go on holiday, I remember the excitement of going to the bookshop at the airport and choosing at least three books. Because you'd gone through the luggage weighing bits.
Yes.
Books are remarkably heavy.
They are.
I remember Charlotte Betts, who we interviewed well over a year ago, being very excited because one of her books had been chosen for W.H. Smith's Airport shops, as opposed to high street shops. I think they do have a different selection of books.
I wonder if that would be the book of hers that's set in India. So it has that far away places thing. So, you know, that maybe they choose on that basis that people are looking for far away places or things connected to maybe where they're travelling.
Well, I deliberately avoided airport bookshops this time with all the travelling because I had, you know, we took something like 6 books and Kindles and iPads, all with books on. Yeah. So I kind of went through the airport with blinkers.
Try not to.
I find a holiday time when I'm not going to be writing or working and I'm just spending time sitting around a pool or on a beach, I find that the time to catch up on my Sudoku, really. But I do like to look at, you know, what other people are recommending. And Richard and Judy's summer reads, sometimes they're very lightweight and easy to read, but they've got some really quite heavyweight books on their list this summer. So they're recommending The Stranger Diaries, which is Ellie Griffith's a murder mystery with ghoulishly gothic undertones. I think that would add to my cognitive load. Michael Connelly's Dark Sacred Night. And Michael Connelly, again, tends to be
quite
thrillers.
Dark. Yeah. Quite dark. Yeah, thrillers,
An Unwanted Guest by Shari Lapena, which is a locked room murder mystery.
Oh, I couldn't read that.
The Lost Man by Jane Harper, Death in the Outback. So anybody going to Australia?
Yeah, I would read that if I was going to the Outback.
Something in the Water by Catherine Stedman, The Perfect Crime.
Something in the Water.
And An Unsuitable Woman by Kat Gordon, which is a lost era laced with lust, secrets and betrayal. That sounds less load on my cognitive.
No, that sounds a bit more escapist, doesn't it?
But, you know,
but there's nothing there that
you would say that's a
automatically
big treat.
Right, that's
a big treat.
And just on that point, I actually would prefer to read a physical book on holiday because, you know, I read from Kindle and computer screens and everything all the time. So the real treat of having a physical book in my hands.
I always think when you're on a beach or by a pool, having your Kindle is a bit dangerous because they get sat on, they get covered in sand, they get sand splashed, dropped in the pool.
About 10 years ago, people went to e-readers in a big way. And what you found in the holiday resorts was the book swaps declined massively and they just had some tatty old Victoria Holts and things that were left behind.
Nothing wrong with it.
I like Victoria Holt.
No, nothing, but they were tatty and old books that were
well
thumbed,
like us.
Recently published, was my point. And,
tatty and old,
I love book swaps.
I beg your pardon.
I think they're a brilliant invention. You know, whoever in a resort first thought up the idea, I'm deeply grateful to
but
them.
Anyway, but books have made a comeback. People are reading physical books. You know, I do find the Kindle handy to carry down to the beach. I mean, just a towel and the Kindle, you don't need anything else. But I also do carry huge heavy tomes with me. If that's what I'm reading, I take
it
with
me. Not only your cognitive load but your physical load as well.
But I was interested to read that the so-called airport novel is not defined by genre or content, but by size.
Really?
So the likes of Wilbur Smith, they're famous for big books. And the idea is that you've got something that you can get stuck into and will keep you going for a week or a fortnight.
Rather than buying 4 or 5 short, easy reads.
We bought books for our grandchildren to take on holiday and my grandson picked the biggest. He didn't mind what the title was. He wanted the biggest.
Yes.
Because then he had more to read.
Yeah. Well, that's great, isn't it? I love that.
Let's just get really clear here. So airport books are good chunky books.
And a classic airport novel, by definition, is a longer than average book.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting because I think if you're travelling, you might want to be aware of the bulk and the weight. You know, because if you have, you know, you have your carry bag with you that you take on the plane or your extra little laptop. And mine is always chock full because I have to have potato chips and pretzels and candy.
I think maybe the day of the classic airport novel kind of predates a little bit, you know, EasyJet and Ryanair where we're all going hand luggage only or, you know, people perhaps have bigger luggage allowance as well. That might be another thing. But as Nicola suggested, once you're through security, you can buy and carry what you like, but you've still got to carry it. Right. You know.
But if you buy it and read it on holiday, you can leave it behind.
Yes. Exactly.
Yeah. But then, if you love a book, do you want to leave it behind?
Mm.
No. Well, that's a decision, isn't it?
Yeah.
But apparently over 240 million travellers come into contact with the WH Smith brand every
year. Which is a UK
brand. 240 million travellers.
Yeah, so they're everywhere. They are global. Mm.
Yeah.
You noticed then when you were travelling in the States that it was WH Smith.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes.
Well, they 151 of their travel units are in airports.
Right.
So, and there aren't 151 in the UK, so...
Yeah. And they're in train stations. I think they train stations they started first before.
Hospitals and so on. Yeah. So, a few to look out for. There's The Porpoise by Mark Haddon, who wrote The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime.
What's wrong, Linda?
Porpoise.
Porpoise. It's a porpoise.
Oh, did you say that on porpoise? Or on
porpoise? Well done.
Oh, gosh.
What else have we got? Oh, yeah, my favourite, Big Sky by Kate Atkinson, with the return of Jackson Brodie for Kate Atkinson fans. That's definitely one.
I think I've got that one pre-ordered.
Yep, definitely one for the suitcase. Oh, this was nice. This one you might like. City of Girls by Elizabeth Gilbert.
This looks great.
It's young women come of age in wartime New York.
Oh.
In the new novel from the author of Eat, Pray, Love.
Oh, I liked her books. So, yeah.
I haven't read Eat, Pray, Love.
I had to skip the whole India section, but apart from that, it was all okay.
What else have we got? Oh, another one for Linda. Uh-huh. But not due till August. The Nickel Boys by Colson Whitehead, which is the follow-up to The Underground Railroad.
Oh.
And that features two young black boys, one holding on to his idealism, one bitterly cynical, who are sent to a horrific reform school based on a real establishment in Jim Crow era Florida.
Oh, horrible.
It does sound horrible.
Yeah.
But no doubt a good read. But
Interestingly, when I was looking at this, a lot of the lists of what's been actually read and not the new releases, Goodreads has got a huge list of what's hot at the moment. And it's The Perks of Being a Wallflower, Stephen Chbosky, The Time Traveller's Wife, 13 Reasons Why by Jay Asher, The Book Thief, Gone Girl, The Fault in Our Stars. So all, you know,
everyone's catching up on
this. There's some Doku.
Yeah. They're catching up.
So I just found the difference with none of these.
Yeah.
And then on other lists, there was quite a bit of Stephen King and Robert Jordan.
Yeah. Perennial favourites.
Catching up on things.
Yeah. One I thought might be a good one, Platform 7 by Louise Doughty. Suicide at Peterborough Railway Station, a high concept thriller from the author of Appletree Yard.
What's a high concept thriller?
I'm not sure. I was going to ask that. Do we know what a high concept thriller is?
All right. Well, it means fashion. That the publisher wants you to buy it more than they want you to buy something else.
Okay.
Okay.
We need to know what a high concept thriller
right.
is.
Right. Can someone out there give us a post on the Facebook group and tell us what a high concept thriller might be?
Thanks. Yeah, good idea.
Okay. Well, thank you for your thoughts on that, ladies. Okay, now, Heather and I have been very fortunate and had the opportunity to interview Simone Hubbard, who's just published her debut novel, which is called Under a Greek Spell, which sounds very much like the sort of thing that a lot of people would want to read on holiday.
Our guest today is Simone Hubbard, author of Under a Greek Spell. We read on her website that she found the whole process a rather steep learning curve, more a vertical line, and she hopes that any would-be writers will be encouraged to give it a go. So, hello Simone, thank you for joining us. And can you tell us a little bit about Simone Hubbard?
I can. Hi everybody. Simone Hubbard is my writing name. So I'm Simone Pottage. I'm 50 years old and I married Chris 2 years ago. I have a stepdaughter Lizzie who's 17 and a stepson Sam who's 15. I was previously married to my first husband Martin for 24 years. who was diagnosed with cancer and sadly passed away in November 2013. Chris, Lizzie and I live in a town called Chapel-on-le-Frith, which is on the outskirts of the Peak District. So Chris and I like to go out walking and cycling in our area when we can. We also sing in a local choir and we go ballroom dancing every week as well. And I've lived here since I was four. I worked at TSB Bank for almost 30 years and left in June 2015.
Thanks very much for that. Of course, as we know, I live in Buxton, which is just a few miles away from Chapel-on-le-Frith. Have you always known you wanted to be a writer?
I loved writing short stories and poems as a child at school, and our headmaster was particularly keen to encourage creative writing. And I've still got my little books from school with the little stories in there, which is always interesting to read. And I started when I started at work at TSB, I found a little niche for writing odes for my colleagues for things like birthdays and when they were getting married, etc. So they'd always open a card and find a little poem in there. I did actually attempt to write a children's book in the 1990s, but I didn't make very much progress with it, probably because I didn't have a very good structure to actually write in, and I was probably working full-time at the time and didn't have any more time, you know, to actually concentrate on writing it. But yeah, I've always got a story going off in my head, that's for sure.
And you're involved with some writing group?
I am. When I started writing Under a Greek Spell, I wasn't in any writing group and I'd pretty much written the book before I joined a creative writing group locally in 2015. The thing with the writing group is it does help to take me away from my own book and to write about other things, which I can then use in my spoken word evening, which I run every 2 months. So I think that for creative purposes, that being in that writing group makes you think about other things apart from your own project that you might have.
But did you take your novel at any point or sections of the novel to share with the group? Did they have any input at all?
There's been the odd little thing that I have done with them. They knew I was doing it, but it's not something that I've worked on at that writing group, because the people that are leading the group have always had a programme that we've sort of set out collectively. Yeah, I chose the route of having my work critiqued privately, and I, you know, paid for that service, because I did have a couple of friends read my early drafts. They, you know, spoke about it favourably, which then gave me the confidence to carry on and finish and then send it for a proper paid for critique. When that critique came back, I was quite, you know, confident and pleased with that critique, and I'm glad that I'd chosen that route.
That's the fiction feedback.
The reason why I got down the line of using fiction feedback was I was just talking to somebody at dancing actually, and she said, oh, we know somebody that's published a book through Troubadour and spoken very highly of them. So I went to Troubadour's website, and there they were basically saying, we need the manuscript to be of quite a high standard before we'll take a manuscript on. That was why I went down the route of fiction feedback, because they were on one of the recommendations to use to get your manuscript polished and in a position for Troubadour to say, yes, we're happy to proceed. So that was my aim, to have a highly polished manuscript to send off to any would-be publisher, really.
Can you just explain a little bit about who Troubadour are?
They are publishers, but they're also a self-publishing arm. Matador is the self-publishing side. Troubadour is the actual company name. So when I sent the manuscript in, I think it was about sort of this time last year, they say yes or no. So that was a yes, we're happy to proceed. They then emailed, the different steps that we would be taking. And then just sort of got into the process at about September last year when the manuscript was sent to them. And then they took over the process then they obviously, when you're in a process, the book has to go through their process. So you know you're not going to miss any steps, like, for example, getting your ISBN numbers sorted out. So they did all that. There's so many different things. They chose the font that that the book finally had. So they made a suggestion, and actually when I saw their suggestion, I was happy with that. They made the suggestion with the running titles at the top of each page, which I'd never even given to a second thought about. And if you look at the top of some books, it'll have the author name and the name of the book. They suggested with mine, because I'm alternating from two different characters most of the time, to have the character name as the running title at the top of each page on the, I think it's the right-hand side. That was a very, very useful tip that they came up with, and somebody has actually commented that that was something that they have found useful. Because from the author's point of view, you know your character. From the reader's point of view, when it's flicking from two, you sometimes you're not real sure which character you're reading about. And I found that in a book that I read recently where they were alternated between two characters. And then you go on to things like, you know, choosing the book cover. That's obviously a huge thing. And I've got quite a vivid idea of what I wanted the cover to look like. They came back with a suggestion, which I absolutely hated. I immediately rejected it. I was a bit worried for about a week or so, to the point of actually designing a book cover myself with Sam, my stepson. We used a lot of clip art and dragged it onto the computer and got an idea from that, so that if they came back with another cover that I didn't like, I could say, look, this is what I want, something like this. But luckily, when they came back with that second book cover, which I was pretty happy with that, and we only had to do some minor changes on it. So just little things that made it more specific to Mykonos, like the windmills on the left-hand spine, because Mykonos, that they are synonymous with Mykonos town. I know there's the risk, well, maybe the person that designed the first cover was thinking along the lines of the Shirley Ballantyne era, which was actually that film was released in 1989. So the first cover had quite a rustic chair and table, and I think it's quite a cosmopolitan town, and I just wanted the cover to look a little bit more modern and chic. So hence I gave them some very specific instructions of what chairs I wanted and what table I wanted and and things like that. So the little added touches that they did, like those olives in the corner, you know, that was certainly something that I wouldn't have thought of, and it is something that's mentioned in the book. So I was really pleased with that cover, and I know lots of people have picked it up. It does appeal. So I'm glad that I stuck to my guns with it. And, yeah, so the troubadour process, I think basically it's a fail-safe way of somebody going into the self-publishing route of making sure that at the end you've got a product that you're 100% happy with. Every single time without fail that I've rung them, there's a customer service person at the end where the phone is actually answered. And if you've not if you've not managed to speak to the person you wanted to speak to, because there's lots of different people in the process, they've certainly got back to me by phone or by email. So I really recommend them.
Yeah, great advice, advice. What motivated you to keep going?
Yes, indeed. What indeed? There's a lot of determination with it. And that's something that I've proved to myself in my lifetime of, you know, starting a project and finishing it. It might not be as timely as some people can do it, but I take great pride in thinking that I'm quite a perfectionist, and particularly with this book, I wanted this to be a good, well-polished, finished article. I've gone that sort of extra mile and paid quite a lot of money to have it professionally critiqued and edited, or before that even, the things like the structural edit and the copy editing. So I really had to treat it like at times it's quite an indulgent, expensive hobby. I take my hat off to anybody that can write and make it pay the bills, because they certainly wouldn't be paying any bills. But there's, you know, there's, who knows, there's the opportunity, I think, to, you know, go on to the next steps with it and, you know, take it on to the next level, because the feedback I've got has been amazing. I think the thing to keep me motivated and with that goal in mind of the finished product, I did I joined a group in 2014, which was just after Martin had passed away, and it took me massively out of my comfort zone. And it was a little bit like goal setting in the morning and then doing some really different things in the afternoon. We actually had us doing belly dancing, meditation, street art, all sorts of different things that just take you a little bit out of your comfort zone, which I think is not necessarily a bad thing. But one of the things for me was always, because I'd started this book, that I would write the novel, finish the novel, and have a book in print. And the goal was always the same thing, you know, finish writing Under a Greek Spell. With one of the sort of meditation things, picturing your goal and what the finished thing would be. And for me, it was basically having a book launch. In my mind, I was picturing the Leeward Hotel with lots and lots of guests and bottle of champagne, etc., etc. When it came to it, I actually reconsidered that, because I've actually had experience of speaking to large numbers of people, and I don't know, well, you'll know, trying to keep people's attention is difficult. So in the end, I did the book launches, three smaller book launches, which worked a lot better, I think. It was definitely the way to go. You know, we did a similar to what we're doing today. I did it with somebody that I used to work with. We sat at the front and did, like I say, set questions like we're doing today, and then threw it open to the audience. And I think if we'd have had a bigger audience, it would have just gone on too long. So as it was, the whole thing from start to finish was an hour, and giving everybody in the room the opportunity to ask a question that hadn't been answered in our question and answer session that we prepared. So I was really pleased with the outcome on that.
So I suppose, going back to the beginning, why was the setting Greece? What made you pick Greek Island?
Martin was diagnosed with cancer, as I said, in January 2013. And when he'd had his chemo treatment, we wanted to go away somewhere. And, well, you probably would know that people, when they've had chemo, it's a very difficult time to be going away. So we wanted to choose somewhere where they spoke English. And we went to Cyprus. And unfortunately, he had gastroenteritis, so we did have to go into a clinic for one night. And that made me start, because I was on my own, I was noticing people around me. I don't know whether Heather remembers Bridget the Fidget in the book.
Yes, yes.
Bridget was one of the people that was in on that holiday in Cyprus. Well, Bridget kept adjusting a bikini. I think she was wanting to optimise the sun in all areas, driving me absolutely bonkers. I think if it had been with Martin, I probably wouldn't have noticed her, you see. Because he was away for about, I don't know, probably just over a day. Certainly had an overnight in the clinic, so I had to go and eat on my own at this hotel. Not an experience I'd want to repeat particularly, but it did make me open up to observing other people, and it all fell into place really. And on our last day, one of the people that are in the book, Nikos, he's actually a waiter at the hotel where we stopped in Cyprus. And just observing him, I just thought, you know, he'd be a lovely person to have as a character in a book. Mm. He was the porter, so I actually promoted him to a receptionist, didn't I, in the book. But yeah, so when I got on the plane, I started thinking about all these different things and a story. Got home and I actually downloaded Scrivener to write in. And I got going a couple of days after, and I was typing away quite happily. I think because I'd paid for it, I was determined to get going with it. So Yeah, so I originally started with the characters being called Stephanie and Stella. And Stephanie was the one that made it end up being a story from Greece, because she decided that she wanted to be called Shirley Valentine. Mm-hmm. All those ideas that I had in my head were from Cyprus. The hotel was from Cyprus. The bus journey into town was Cyprus to Paphos. So I had to do a big rewrite to accommodate Stephanie's little giggle that she wanted to have with Kostas about being called Shirley Valentine. So then I had to start, you know, researching Shirley Valentine, and thought, well, actually, that'd be quite a good way to go, because if she actually was in Mykonos saying she's called Shirley Valentine, then it could be a bit of a joke that sort of comes back to bite a bum, which of course it does. I had a lot of fun with that, and of course then that took me on another journey, and I managed to go to Mykonos, and I actually did walk around Mykonos as the two characters, as the two sisters, Helen one day and Stephanie the other, because I then knew what they were both there for. And I thought it was a really good experience, because there's lots of that gone in the book that just wouldn't have been there otherwise. So that's where we ended up in Greece. I'm glad I went to Mykonos, because I can do a lot of research online, but like I say, I don't think that Mykonos is your typical Greek island. I've been to places like Crete and Corfu, and I think that to me they're more typical Greek, whereas, like I say, Mykonos I think is a very cosmopolitan town.
Yeah.
So it was a good job I went, really.
Very sophisticated, I think. Yeah. Can I ask you why you chose to write in the first person? Did that just happen, or did you make a conscious decision to go that way?
Yeah, well, prior to me writing my book, I'd been lent a book by somebody I worked with, which was called Wedding Night by Sophie Kinsella. And I absolutely loved the way that she wrote. And she wrote in the first person and also alternated between two sisters. And interestingly, this story goes to Greece as well. I don't know. I just find it easier to write in the first person. A lot of my stuff that I do for creative writing is also in the first person. I don't know. That would be a challenge for me to actually try and write any other way, really.
Okay, well, thanks very much for that. So just last question, what next for Simone Hubbard?
I was wanting to get the feedback about Under a Greek Spell, which has been overwhelmingly positive. Lots of people have asked, you know, are you writing another novel? One of the big things seems to be that people don't want the book to end. They want it to carry on. That could lend itself to maybe a sequel to Under a Greek Spell. I've got a couple of other little projects as well. I quite like writing about the town, Chapel Enifrith. Mm-hmm. But from just getting a little bit of history on paper from a person's perspective, we've got a lot of photographs going around on growing up in Chapel Enifrith on Facebook. But it's more that the stories, just the little things that if we don't get them down on paper are just going to be forgotten about. So that's a little project that I could maybe do as well. I also do my open mic, so I have to be, I like to do a bit of something that's original for that. And then we've been wanting to get the computer sorted out so that when I actually do get to using it and writing on it again, that it's actually going at a speed that that keeps up with me. So we've just done that last week. So I'm just in the middle of putting everything back on. And then you run out of excuses. So I think it's a case of, you know, perhaps when we get back from our holiday in July, that I try and, you know, start that process again. I think what I probably need to do is write the book and then just do some other things on the side as well, that are, again, with short stories and what have you.
And will you go down the self-publishing route again, or will you try sending to?
I think once I've got on with another novel, which would, like I say, would be easy to do a sequel because you've already got the characters in your head.
Yeah.
I would probably go back to one publisher that said, we like this, and if you've got two or three books, we'd be probably interested in doing, you know, publishing for you. In the old old days. In the olden days, when I started writing this, self-publishing wasn't really even an option. That shows how fast that's grown, that market. So during the process, that if you were self-publishing, that was sort of it. But I think the publishers have had a bit of a wake-up call. Well, not a wake-up call. It's probably quite easy for them now because they can. You do all the hard work. If you've got a finished article that you think, oh, yes, I quite like that, then they can swoop down and say, all right, we'll give you a publishing deal. So who knows? Certainly that isn't a problem anymore that you've self-published. It certainly was partway through my process where it was like, well, if you're going down self-publishing, that's the route you're going down. But now I think that's done a bit of a U-turn, so we'll shall see.
Great. Well, thank you very much for joining us. It's
thank
been
you.
A pleasure. Congratulations at your book in print.
Thank you.
And good luck with the next one.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, it's nearly time to wrap up for this week. But before we do, Steph is going to be telling us what's on her bedside table, and so is John Lomas Bullivant. Steph?
Okay, this book I'm reading is called Into the Blue. It's by Robert Goddard. It's the first of Robert Goddard books that I've ever read, but apparently he's written many, many, many books. But I'm reading this because it was chosen by somebody for one of the book clubs I'm a member of. It's about Harry Barnett, who's an Englishman who's said to be on permanent vacation in Greece, house-sitting for a powerful friend and hiding from the past. It's got a lot of great write-ups. It's effectively a mystery. I found it a little bit slow to get going because in the initial chapters there's quite a lot of scene setting and so on. However, now that I've really got into it, I can't stop turning the pages because I just really need to know what happens. I think maybe the author wanted us to feel how jaded Harry was because he's been living in Greece for years because of some past failures, and he's only goes back once a year to see his mother, and he basically is, you know, haunted by all these failures, and I think that's led to him being very jaded and sedentary, and this whole event is now going to change everything about the way that he's living, and he's suddenly going to have to get very active and revisit his past. There's no gore or explicit violence yet, and there's nothing too sinister to scare me, and nothing too distasteful to distract me, just sufficient mystery and enough at stake to have drawn me in, because I don't like gory thrillers and things like that. So far so good. I'm enjoying it. The other thing is that there's a lot of the setting, apart from the settings in Greece, there's settings of Swindon, Oxford, Burford, Marlborough, Didcot, which is all my local area. Oh, okay. So I'm quite enjoying visiting those places with him as well. So yes, Into the Blue by Robert Goddard.
Thank you. And now John Lomas Bullivant is going to share what's on his bedside table.
On my bedside table at the moment is a book called, do we know this one, The Train to Impossible Places? So this is by P.G. Bell, and as ever, I occasionally, well, fairly regularly walk into Waterstones, which is an extremely masochistic experience for anybody who is trying to create new stories, because you're just overwhelmed by how many are there, and you think, why am I bothering? Anyway, once you get over that, you start to look around, and The Train to Impossible Places caught my eye because it's my kind of title. I think it's a good title, and I immediately wanted to know more about it, and I like the cover. I was fortunate enough to be actually seeing the publisher a couple of weeks later and mentioned to them that I was impressed because it's published by Usborne. She very kindly gave me a copy. So that was good. It's about a girl called Susie Smith who is into physics, which I think is probably one of the USPs that the agent used to sell it. So girl into science, and they set that up pretty quickly. And she encounters a world which doesn't really follow the laws of physics. She wakes up in the middle of the night in probably chapter one, and there's a train in her living room, which clearly isn't possible, but there is. You know, it's a full-size train and the house is sort of disordered. And she discovers that this magical world operates on the laws of physics, which is like physics, fuzzier. So she's generally outraged because you can't mess with physics because basically the laws are sort of like finite. Anyway, so that's kind of the probably the good selling theme for schools and what have you. And she joins the Impossible Postal Express, which is basically a train that delivers to weird, wonderful, magical places and driven by two trolls. And she joins in as the inadvertent sort of postmistress. It's a first-time writer, so I'm impressed that he's got it away. It's imaginative, my kind of places that are imagined. I'm struggling slightly with Susie because she's not my kind of character. It's one of those stories that you can do in publishing, I think, where chapter one is there's a train in my lounge, I have a squabble and a fight, and I get on the train, and then I'll worry about where it's going as the story unfolds. And you've no idea who Susie is, if you see what I mean. You've not really established her character, so we don't know what's at stake for her, other than she gets annoyed that physics is bent out of all proportion, but gets used to that. But we don't know what she needs to learn from the journey. So I'm going through wondering whether I'm starting to care a little bit less about her now, because I'm not sure what's at stake, other than she has to get home, which she will obviously do because she's not going to be stranded because it's a kid's book. And secondly, there's a mystery to solve, obviously, which she gets her teeth stuck into and she's partly responsible for. It's an intriguing book. I haven't got to the end. I can't go whether the writer pulls it off or not. I'm enjoying it, and I will tell the publisher I did like it because it would be foolish not to.
Well, that's the end of Write Club, the podcast for this week. We hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll join us again next time. But meanwhile, if you haven't already joined Write Club, the podcast group on Facebook, why not do so and invite a friend to as well? And then you can be part of all the fun. Goodbye till next time.
Bye.
I never know what.